This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about Israel's continued ethnocide of the Palestinians.
How much longer will the world let this go on? We'll have two guests discuss the tragedy that has become Palestine.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there's a new development out of Sweden with the Julian Assange case. Can you bring our listeners up to date, please?
Well, the positive part of the development is that Julian's lawyers in Sweden filed a case to set aside the arrest warrant. The arrest warrant was for sexual misconduct allegations, not charges, in Sweden. The arrest warrant was issued in 2010, almost 4 years ago, actually. In November, it'll be 4 years. And since that time, Julian has been in some form of custody. First, it was a custody with a bracelet in England, confined to a certain place to live. And then when the arrest warrant was going to be executed on an extradition warrant in the UK, he took refuge and got asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. So he's been in the embassy now for just over 2 years. And the Swedish prosecutor claims that she wants to question Julian in Sweden. Now, of course, Julian, if he leaves the embassy, will be sent to Sweden. And then on his lawyer's advice, mine and others, he has been told that Sweden will be essentially a one-way ticket to the United States. What does he do now? He said, look, why don't they come and question me in the embassy? And he's made that request in every different way he can. Question me in writing, question me by Skype, question me by phone, question me in person. But the Swedish prosecutor has refused. So here it's 4 years later, been in custody for 4 years. There's been a warrant for his arrest for 4 years. The Swedish prosecutor has failed to do what she can to question him or move the case forward. And it seems to the lawyers in Sweden and to a lot of us to be disproportionate now. There's only allegations, there's no charges. So the lawyers in Sweden moved today as we speak for a court hearing and had a court hearing today in Sweden to say the warrant ought to be lifted. There's no probable cause for holding him. They should be forced to question him in the embassy or get rid of this case, et cetera. And a number of charges like that, a number of claims like that, many of which are very solid legal claims. At least that's the way it sounds to me sitting here in the U.S. Unfortunately, in a very brief decision after a court hearing today, the Swedish judge denied the claims of Julian Assange to quash the arrest warrant and to give any other the relief he asked for. So it's disappointing. But on the other hand, I think the lawyers think it's such a solid case that on appeal and ultimately in a European Court of Human Rights or a European court, he'll be able to vindicate his rights. We do hope he's able to do so. It does seem to be really amazing to me that you can keep someone in custody for 4 years on allegations alone. The longest time that the Swedish have ever kept someone in custody pursuant to allegations. And there's also been efforts in the UN to complain about the Swedish treatment and media really beginning to understand the issue.
But Michael, what's the real reason they've done this to him? Why have they jammed him up for 4 years?
Right. The question I get asked often is what's really going on here? And the question we got today when it looked like we, you know, there's a potential for getting the arrest warrant quashed. Well, could he then walk out of the embassy? If Sweden goes away, can he walk out of the embassy? And again, lawyers' advice to Julian has been you can't because at this point the U.S. is still breathing down your neck. And in April of this year, they just, in a court filing, said we're still investigating WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and we have our criminal division and our national security division investigating him. We know there's been a long-term investigation for years by a grand jury. Witnesses have been called. So the problem is not Sweden. The immediate problem we have to get rid of is Sweden because he'd be taken right there. So the real solution here, getting rid of the United States investigation is obviously one, but the real one is getting the United States, Sweden, and the UK to recognize Julian's right of asylum, let him walk out of that embassy, get on an airplane, and recognize that right when he gets to Ecuador, which is where he's been given asylum.
One last question, Michael, and this is directed at our new listeners. What did Julian Assange do to merit this special treatment?
Oh, by the United States? Yes. We can give you the history again, but it started with the collateral murder video, which showed U.S. soldiers in an Apache gunship shooting down two Reuters journalists, and then the people who were trying to give them aid afterwards by getting their bloodied bodies off the ground. He then did the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, diplomatic cables, and zillions of other things about countries all over the world. Brought us everything, arguably, from Arab Spring to the secret war in Yemen. And so he's been a very important figure in really what I would say cracking open government secrecy and criminality all over the world. WikiLeaks was set up in 2008. The U.S. government has been out to destroy WikiLeaks since 2008.
Michael, the author of the torture memo, John Yoo, who was then working in the Bush White House, has just been awarded an endowed faculty chair at the University of California in Berkeley School of Law. What's your thought about Professor Yoo getting an endowed chair at a prestigious law school?
Well, John Yoo was one of the principal authors of memos that gave the legal arguments, if you want to call the arguments he gave legal, justifying and allowing torture. They're the memos that the CIA and Rumsfeld and others used when they came up with torture techniques, and they said, well, these aren't really torture, they're something else. And I won't go through the reasoning, but it's out-reasoning that I would have flunked any of my first-year law students for. Let's put it that way. So now John Yoo, who's been teaching at Berkeley for a number of years, he was in the government, taught at Berkeley, went back to Berkeley, has now been given an endowed chair. I mean, it's incredible. We live in a country where not only isn't he investigated and prosecuted, but he's actually given an endowed chair. I mean, I don't know what else he can say about the country, and particularly that law school, Berkeley. To the extent Berkeley was something else, Michael, when you and I were around in the late 60s and 70s, and it was a hotbed of tremendous radicalism, it's now a hotbed of the radicalism of the torturer. But, you know, while I would never justify anybody being tortured, or happened to have happened to them what happened to my clients at Guantanamo. If you were thinking about a chair and you want the kind of chair that John Yoo would sit in, it would be like one of the restraint chairs where they strap down Guantanamo detainees, put a half-inch wide, perhaps, tube down their nose into the stomachs and force feed them various, quote, foods like Ensure to break their hunger strike. And they do it as a method of breaking the hunger strike through torture. So that's the kind of chair that perhaps, if one were to ever want him to get a chair, it would be that chair. But, of course, I recommend that for no human being. The other kind of chair is another client, Mohammed El-Khatani, who was put into a strapped-in chair at Guantanamo. There was a log made of the torture he underwent in that chair. It's actually documented in my book, The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld, which has the document of the log in there, how he's strapped into the chair. Of course, he's stripped, et cetera, and then they start pumping liquids into him so that he has to urinate, et cetera. Other things happen to him while he's put into that chair. So while, as I want to again say, I think none of this is appropriate for anybody who's a human being, and I still consider John Yoo to be within that sort of broad definition of human being, if you want to make it a broad definition, should be put into a type of chair. But if we're thinking about a chair, let's think about those chairs and not the chair that John Yoo was outrageously given by Berkeley.
This month, in an attempt to break apart the newly formed coalition government in Palestine between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, the Israeli army first rampaged through the West Bank and then launched an aerial strike against Gaza called Operation Protective Edge. Israeli jets dropped hundreds of bombs on the coastal enclave of nearly 2 million Palestinians, killing 200 of them, injuring 1,400, 78%, according to the United Nations civilians. We're joined today by Philip Weiss to talk about the situation in Palestine. Weiss is the founder and editor of Mondo Weiss, an online news source about the conflict in Israel, as well as one of the editors of the book on the Goldstone Report called The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. Phil Weiss, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. It's my pleasure to be here.
Phil, we've all been following very closely the developments in the Gaza Strip and before that, the week before that, in the West Bank. In a nutshell, can you tell us what you think is going on?
In a nutshell, I think that Israel is trying to destroy the unification agreement between Hamas and Fatah. This is war, in this case, war is diplomacy by another means. And they don't want the diplomacy. They want to end that unification deal. It was a huge event in which Islamic and more militant wing of Palestinian political life joined with Fatah, the old guard in Palestinian political life, and said, we're going to work together. And it's a great danger to Israel that the Palestinians are united. They want them divided, and they've used any pretext they can in the last month, including the horrifying abduction and killing of these Israeli teens on the West Bank. They've used any pretext they can to break up, to try to break up that understanding.
What would have the goals of the unified Palestinian government been?
I think that the goals of the unified Palestinian government are to achieve some type of Palestinian freedom. That's the greatest threat, is that they would go on to, say, the International Criminal Court. They would go to international bodies and say, hey, this occupation has been going on nearly 50 years. How are you going to celebrate the jubilee of the occupation? Are you going to finally give us a state, sovereignty? If we can't get sovereignty, then we are going to move toward an equal rights struggle. That, I think, is happening. That's one of the great things about, as disastrous and horrifying as these images are that we're getting from Palestine and from and Israel too, I think the good thing is that they show that there is no green line. The partition that the world tried to set up in 1947, there's no partition. Israel operates with impunity and with complete autonomy all over historical Palestine. They regard it as their territory. Netanyahu has said, we're never giving up the West Bank. So it's very clear that this is one state, and I think that it makes it, it's sort of an announcement to the world, these events, that it is one state, and we're on the threshold of a struggle for equal rights within that one state.
Phil, I'm interested in your response to the humanitarian disaster that's going on. I mean, it's impossible almost to watch the killings that the Israelis are carrying out right now in Gaza. We, of course, saw it before in 2008, 2009. But the world just seems to let it happen, and they're letting the bombs go off, kill majority civilians. What's your reaction to it? What can be done?
Well, obviously, I mean, your response, and I think you showed great leadership the last time during CAST-LED, the legal response to this, and the one that you demonstrated the last time during CAST-LED, was this is international humanitarian law and human rights law apply here. And the Israel should be brought up before international bodies for violating those laws. And the Palestinian Center for Human Rights has said so. You have nearly 150 civilian deaths, nearly 40 of them children. I think the one thing that the one element of progress, and this is a horrifying form of progress, but the one form of progress is there's no ground invasion this time. When Norman Finkelstein wrote his book saying we went too far this time about CAST-LED in 08-09, Israel absorbed that lesson. They went too far. And that was an instance in which over 3 weeks they killed 1,400 people, nearly 400 children, nearly 1,000 civilians. And I don't think, you know, happily, it's not happening on that scale. And so
it isn't, but it's still massive. This is only 3 or 4 days now. How many days has it been?
9 days.
So 9 days. So it's 200 people in 9 days. So last time it was 3 weeks and about 1,400 people, right?
Yes.
So let me ask you this, though. Recently there was an order from the Israelis, or more than a suggestion, but a statement that Palestinians ought to evacuate northern Gaza. And yes, then they drop leaflets and all this. It's like some 100,000 people live in northern Gaza.
The Israelis made phone calls to the homes that affect 100,000 people. They knew everybody's phone number. They had them all on robocalls telling them to get out.
Yes.
That's how creepy it is.
But of course, there's nowhere to go. So, Phil,
yes.
Where do the people go? What's your response to this? And when you say they learned a lesson about maybe not using ground troops, this doesn't sound so great.
Of course not. But I accept your points, Michael, but I would respond, do you see any progress in terms of the Western discourse around this slaughter compared to the slaughter of 08 and 09?
I'll say this. I see none in the Western press that I read.
Really?
Oh, I think the articles I read an article by Susan Estridge yesterday, former advisor to Clinton, that just was like foaming at the mouth against the Palestinians. And I don't see a huge change in the Western press. Maybe you've seen something I haven't seen. I have not seen that. And the whole thing about the ceasefire that just was put forward, it was a complete ploy. What it was done by Egypt,
yes,
purposely to get closer to the United States, apparently.
Uh-huh.
And it had nothing the Hamas could have agreed to. So Israel accepts it so they can look like they're in favor of it.
Yeah.
Hamas can't accept it because there's nothing. They're being economically strangled. They can't even pay their people. And so that's just another ploy. And the Western press went right along with it. Yes, I could read the Times, and if you read carefully, it could say it didn't offer anything to Hamas. So maybe that's better. But I consider it to be, I've never read press this horrible about a situation. It's all about they shouldn't be doing the rockets, or it's all about this is equality. They do the rockets, we do this, you do this, we do the rockets. It's not about saying, you know, maybe something else is going on here. Maybe one country is the colonizer and the oppressor, and maybe the other is the oppressed, and they're resisting.
Well, Michael, you and I have a somewhat different relationship to the mainstream press in that, you know, I used to be part of it, and, you know, now and then I have fantasies of getting back in. Now, given that, with that proviso, I think that there has been a little bit of progress in the mainstream, so that you have on NBC Nightly News, you have words opening that report by saying these people are trapped, they have nowhere to go, and it's a lopsided conflict. I didn't hear that around Castled. I thought there was that was muted and understood, and this time it's understood and not so muted. And so I regard, maybe it's just I'm glass half full, but I feel that people are onto the, this is so.
Let me ask you, has any press that you've read said that the purpose of this is to actually break the Hamas-PA deal, or are they just saying we've got to stop the rockets? That to me is fundamental. If the Western press is saying this is about stopping the rockets, then we got a BS press completely. If they're not saying, look at from Jump Street, this was about destroying Hamas's deal with the PA, then it's not any real progress.
I would say that people like at the margins, such as they are, you have people like Jake Tapper and Chris Hayes on broadcast media who are raising that point, who are saying this is about isn't this about destroying the unification deal? So that is being noised about at the edges of the mainstream press. I accept what you're saying generally, but I think Washington, the think tanks and the suck-ups and all the policymakers in Washington, they're in crisis right now. They are genuinely in crisis.
And what do we see in the papers regarding how scared people are? We see Israelis running around because the rockets and the sirens are going off.
I don't agree with you.
That's what I see.
I think I watch the network news, and I see Ayman Mohideen on NBC News, an Egyptian-American in Gaza, following these families when they're getting into a donkey cart. So, I'm not trying to defend the mainstream so much as say that I feel that there is some real shift going on because the mainstream recognizes the peace process just fell apart. Was this John Kerry spent 9 months of he threw himself into this and there's nothing to show for it.
You know what the Times said today about the peace process? I read it carefully.
Yeah.
It said the peace process fell apart in part because Hamas joined with the PA. Now that is complete crap. That's just complete crap. That's what the Times said today. So if that's what we're getting in our mainstream papers, Phil, I'm sorry. I don't see the progress.
Well, what about liberal Zionists? Are they in crisis? I mean,
having them in crisis is one thing.
Yes.
Saying there's real progress in the media is another. You know, yes, they're in crisis because they don't know what to do now. You know, what are they going to do? They're just bombing people. So they're in crisis.
You know, again, I would say, I'm my temperament, I'm a glass half full person, but I look at the fact that two realists in recent days, Flint Leverett and his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, and Andrew Sullivan, conservative who supported the Iraq War, these influential writers in the sort of realist camp said the two-state solution is finished. Let's forget about it. We're dealing with one state with a struggle for equal rights. And I would remind you, because you were there more than I was, but during South Africa, I can imagine that in 1960, in 1970, in 1975, you could have made the same argument to me about the glacial response of the West to, and,
yes,
and things
I agree
broke.
With that. I agree.
Things broke.
I agree with that. So, but here's the question about half full. I mean, do you want me to call the family that just lost 17 kids in the same household in Gaza? That's not half full. That's empty. We have 200 people have been killed. What do we say about that? Nothing has been done to stop it. The U.S. tomorrow could stop giving the F-35 or F-fighter plane repair parts. Israel would have to stop immediately. It would be over. The U.S. could cut the spigot like that, over for the war. Tomorrow, nothing.
Yeah, you know, Obama bragged that he was solidly behind Israel, and that he said, although money is tight in Washington, we just gave you $3.1 billion for arms, and we're going to give you that amount of money every year through 2018.
I agree that we're seeing some people say we have one state and some like this, some on the edges, not main, yes. main people. But I don't see how it makes any difference in the reality on the ground. That's
you know,
the problem. You know, I don't agree the mainstream has done what you're saying. You know, some of the edges, as you said.
You're putting me in the position of saying what I'm about to say, which is that the murders of the slaughter of 200 people is different from the slaughter of 500 people.
Well, we're still counting, Phil. They're still bombing today.
I understand. And, you know, let me throw something back at you, which is that I've always regarded this in parochial terms. I've regarded this whole issue in parochial terms in as much as I think that my community and your community let me be clear. One of our communities, the Jewish American community, is, I think, highly responsible for this behavior, for this conduct that's going on there. And that the leading elements of that community, the big organizations, the big Jews, the important ones, the big donors, they have a large degree of, if not control, influence over this question. And it's a reactionary community that says Israel can get away with anything.
Phil, this is your Chomsky-Weiss debate.
That's right.
The question is, the Jewish community, this powerful community that is
yes.
dictating U.S. policy more or less,
yes.
or is this a part of U.S. imperialist colonial policy? As Chomsky says, it's shaped like an aircraft carrier. We give it $3.5 billion a year, and this is our aircraft carrier.
And I don't see a U.S. interest there.
Well, you don't see a U.S. interest in a place in which, you know, they have a dictator in Egypt, in which Iraq is going into complete handbasket, in which Iran is a sworn enemy, in which Syria is a complete mess, and they have this one stable, quote, stable outpost that they completely run and have every military piece of equipment they can put in.
You know,
if I were the U.S., that's what I would say. That's my interest.
But then if I was the U.S., then why did George Marshall say to Harry Truman, recognize this place and you're going to have unrest for the
right.
next 70 years?
Right. You're going back.
Why did FDR say you're going to get World War III? And
right.
God... we got World War
right. III. So that's right. So
that was not a U.S. interest.
At that point, that's probably right. At that point, you had Arabists in the State Department. They were influencing the policy. They got pushed out. And now, but we're talking about today.
Yes.
Today, look at that Middle East. If you were sitting in the U.S., what would you say? What would you say about having the militarists in the U.S. say, what the hell? We got this wonderful little aircraft carrier sitting right in the middle.
Well,
Michael,
how useful was that aircraft carrier when we were occupying Iraq and we were invading Afghanistan? Wasn't it all useful to us?
How useful is it today?
You know, it's hard for me to, I think that it's a burden. I think it's a millstone around our necks because it says the United States is slaughtering brown people.
I agree with you from that point of view.
Yeah.
Of course I agree with you. But I'm talking about the militarists in the United States.
Some of these guys, Petraeus has said more about human rights in Israel than in Palestine than just about anyone
correct.
Else
Petraeus,
in the establishment.
Petraeus has.
But
anyway,
it's
a debate you've had
to,
for years with
yes,
Chomsky
I understand.
And if I were measuring IQs, I would go with Chomsky.
you'd be one. That would be a good call.
I don't agree with Chomsky on what he did on BDS and all that. It's another part of the debate, but that's a different question.
No, but I mean, let me go to my parochial point. Okay. I look at the fact that, yesterday I did a piece about this woman in Florida, a congresswoman in Florida, who can't stand up for her 15-year-old constituent who the Israeli police beat the living daylights out of. She can't meet with his relatives because AIPAC has given her money and she's flown to Israel. And that's one where, leaving aside the big picture, let's say Chomsky's right. Chomsky, who ignores the Israel lobby in question entirely. I'm telling you, I look at this from a very parochial standpoint and a narrow standpoint, which is my community has to deal with this question.
I agree with you 100%.
And I think that's something that I can work on,
and I think
personally.
That could make a difference.
Yes.
But I don't think it's, as you and I have already discussed, I don't think it's the bottom line difference of the U.S., but I think it's very important to have the Jewish community change its opinion or the establishment do something different, of
course. And, you know, as Jesus said, you know, the mote in your neighbor's eye is bigger than the beam in your own. I mean,
the mote or the mote?
The mote.
M-O-T-E or mote. M-O-A-T?
He meant that a little speck of dust in someone else's eye is bigger than the beam in your own. That was his, that's about hypocrisy. I feel that, you know, the Jewish community has a lot to deal with here. There are liberal Zionists, right? You look at J Street, this great liberal Zionist organization. They're justifying everything Israel is doing now. There's only a couple of Jewish organizations that have stood up and said, this is wrong.
What are they?
Jewish Voice for Peace and Jews Say No. They're wonderful organizations.
So this sort of goes against what we're talking about is change, because the change, those organizations have been with us for a long time on wanting change to the U.S. policy.
But they're
growing. J Street didn't move an inch. In fact, worse. It to be a completely bankrupt organization, right?
Yes.
But young people don't join AIPAC. Young people join Jewish Voices for Peace.
I agree with you.
And this is a process. It's been going on. You know, I was still in law school in 1967. I remember vividly the 67 war. It was 47 years ago. It's a process. It's going on and it's going on. But if we're talking generations, I think that the reactionary older Jewish generation in this country is losing it.
Yes.
And over the long run, they're going to be replaced by people who are now joining Jewish Voices for Peace. But let me just shift the focus a bit.
Certainly.
Away from our particular and disappointing community. I want to talk about international support that this travesty in Gaza is generating. That'll tend to isolate Israel and make it harder for them to continue their settler operation.
You know, Michael, you may be more abreast of those events than I have. I am. I certainly have noticed the world press. There's a lot of criticism of Israel, but I haven't seen the foreign leaders stepping up? Are some of them?
There have been demonstrations in Africa and Asia.
Oh yes,
Latin America.
Yeah, the people
that we haven't seen before.
Yes,
it's more of a world issue. Israel is the last colonial settler state on the planet.
Yes,
and it's getting increasingly isolated. And increasingly, the spotlight is on it.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's a South Africa process again, that growing awareness. I mean, to just throw in a disclaimer here, Pew just put out a poll showing that American public opinion continues to be retrograde on this question. And with something like 60 to 20 or 55 to 15 Americans tending to support Israel over the Palestinians. Now, the one element of slippage there is that independents are less likely to support Israel than they had been in the past, and even Democrats are a little bit less likely. It's, Republicans are still a stronghold. But I think our public opinion is, as Michael would say, you know, the media are part of this. They're all in on it. It's horrifying.
While you're on this, you know, I sent it to Michael, I think, but the biggest umbrella union, millions of members in South Africa, did an incredible statement. It's called COASTU, and it's the umbrella of all the unions. Israel is only able to commit all these ruthless atrocities because of the license from the U.S., EU, and allies. The U.N. must be ashamed of itself for failing humanity and the people of Palestine, always pleading for restraint for the victim equally. We cannot equate an aggressor to a victim or colonizer to a colonized. Nelson Mandela was also called a terrorist for fighting for freedom. Hence, the natural task of oppressed people to wage a liberation struggle and our natural responsibility to support them. So when we talk about international support, that's COASTU, which is the biggest labor union in South Africa. I mean, huge umbrella, not a union. And then the
So you see progress in
and
that.
And then Unite, which is the UK
union.
Yeah,
the UK has been
It's not as strong as that statement.
But they've been great.
It's a strong statement. It's not like COASTU. But so that is very important that we're starting to see that.
And I would note that in that statement, you know, there's even
Which statement? The UK?
The COASTU that COASTU. You just read. I think there's an implicit understanding around the world now about why these people are firing rockets. You know?
I think that's right.
Even I would say here, Jake Tapper said to Michael Oren on CNN the other day, if you keep denying these people rights and keep hemming them in, they're going to be firing. They're going to their only option is going to be violence. And, you know, Koastu cites Mandela. We can cite our own revolution, you know. And
You know, that means we should probably get a little collection together so I can get a TV. Because I'm unfamiliar with everything you've said to me about the island. I'm serious. Michael and I don't watch this. How did you watch TV?
Yeah.
I'm trying to crawl back into the mainstream, so I have to watch TV.
This is really...
I'm sorry. Yeah. I shouldn't expose that to you.
We need good people in the mainstream.
Forget it. It gets washed like a bug in the mainstream.
I think the analogy is something very close to home in the United States, and that's the American genocide against the Indians. And that's precisely what's going on, but being repeated in Palestine. We're speaking with Phil Weiss, the founder of Mondo Weiss. We'll be right back after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Just tuning in, we're speaking with Phil Weiss, the founder and editor of Mondo Weiss, about the situation in Palestine and the Gaza Strip. Our friend Abdi Jabara passed out 2,000 postcards at a demonstration in the Cape on July 4th of a map of Israel showing how Israel was in 1947 and then after the declaration of statehood in 48 and what it is now. And right now the Palestinians have 22% of the land that they were supposed to have back in 48. And you could say the same thing about where are the Algonquins? Where are the Pequot Indians? They have 0% of the land almost in this country. That's what's happening to the Palestinians. The most accurate term for it is ethnocide, that their culture and their politics is being destroyed. And I think that's what's going on in Gaza, quite intentionally on behalf of the Netanyahu government. They call it mowing the lawn periodically every couple of years. You know, they destroy the infrastructure, they kill a lot of people, and they reduce their standard of living to living on a pile of rubble and hoping you can get clean water. That's the extent of their hopes. They have no hopes. And I think that's intentional. And if Israel has their way, they'll keep it that way forever. They have no long-range plans for Gaza.
Do you see any progress in terms of you just mentioned the global perceptions of this, the global delegitimization of Israel for this conduct. Isn't that something that is moving apace? Again, I'm emphasizing the progress, but...
I do agree with you, and I would ask you to amplify that, because I think that's what's going on. That's part of the process.
Yes.
That Israel is getting
one of our
more
last
isolated.
Questions for Phil, but it's a good one. So I think you should answer
yeah,
that
I
global
mean,
process. You have Koastu. Who else?
Well, one of the things that you're hearing now inside Israel is that there's an existential threat against Israel, which is that people are delegitimizing us. And I think that's great news. You know, when a country conducts itself in that fashion, it does delegitimize itself. It should be considered illegitimate. And that process is taking place. And I, again, emphasizing what I think is the progress, I see more and more international voices talking about this conduct as just beyond the pale. And so that it's not, to take your very dispiriting analogy of the Native Americans, I don't think the Palestinian fate will be ethnocide in the end.
Well, wait a second. It already is getting close. I mean, what are we talking about, Phil? Let's be honest. There's millions of people suffering in horrible refugee camps in Lebanon and in Jordan. And where are they going to go? And I don't get what you're saying. And there's how many Palestinians have been forced out of the Middle East and are working all over the world? Millions? Yeah, probably millions. Okay. So we're already on the way. It's not like it's happened yet, but certainly we're on the way. They've destroyed the culture, you know, of a tremendous number of people. The camp conditions are horrible. They're treated terribly in Lebanon, on parts of Jordan. You know this.
Yes.
And so yes. I would say that, are we 100%? No. Are we 10 or 20%? Sure.
Okay. I accept your point, and I feel that the world is regarding this as a central human rights issue. And again, the South African analogy, it took a while. I mean, here we are sitting in comfortably in New York and talking about the necessary suffering of the Palestinian people in order that they should become a cause internationally. But I think that's the truth there.
Right, but of course, the difference is in South Africa, the blacks didn't get to go anywhere. Palestinians have been forced out and have spread all over the world. So the culture of the blacks in South Africa remained to a large extent.
Phil Weiss, before we let you go, the existential threat here is clearly against the Palestinians. Your website, Mondo Weiss, is one of the most important websites that we know of. I read it every day. So does Michael. So does Heidi. Give us that website before we say goodbye to you so our listeners can tune in to you.
It's mondoweiss.net. And we've been getting, close to a million hits a week during this crisis.
Wow.
Yes.
A million hits a week?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah, it's crazy.
And
that's
now, fantastic.
Can I make one challenge to you before we go?
Sure.
Okay. You know, you and I partnered in a great way on the Goldstone book.
Michael Ratner.
Right? Yes, the Goldstone Report, following Castlet. Mm-hmm. And so you and I had a lot of conversations at that time, and I remember that now and then people would use the word genocide at that time. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear you saying that word, and I guess, and I hear you using it today, and I accept it.
Yeah, I did not use the word genocide today. You misheard.
Oh, well, you're...
I didn't use either.
So I'm misquoting.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Heidi used genocide. Michael used ethnocide.
Okay, but why are you saying that it approaches
a
form
of... I said we were 10% or 20% on the way toward ethnocide.
Okay.
I was picking up on Michael's
term. Forgive me. Okay. Right. But my point is this. I hear that word being used much more commonly now, genocide, than it was during Castlet.
Right.
Isn't that a form of progress that people are using calling a spade, using real – they're seeing this thing more bluntly for what it is. And people, it takes a while for people to grok these things. I remember walking up Broadway with a Palestinian 5 years ago, and he said, "My goal is to end Zionism." And I was shocked by that. And now I would say, "My goal is to end Zionism."
Right.
I heard Hanna Mermelstein outside the Israeli consulate say, "I don't think Israel has a right to exist
Who's
as
Hanna
a Jewish
state."
Hanna Mermelstein of Jewish Voice for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked by this a few years ago. And now I would say, I do not think that a Jewish privileged state should exist. And so I feel that these kind of little advances intellectually are significant. And I forgive me if I got you wrong on that, but I feel that you also have...
No, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just saying, I didn't say it in this particular thing.
Okay. But
yes, there is progress. The question is, how many more years are we going to wait, and how many more Palestinians are going to be destroyed, or their culture destroyed, or, as Michael said, ethnocide? And before they get anything, and if they ever, obviously, two-state is pretty dead, but that was, pretty bad. Well,
it's a hard,
everybody visit Mondo Weiss. It's
you.
One of the great websites. And, Phil, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Phil, for not just for coming all the way down, but for what you do every day, 7 days a week. It's wonderful to be your comrade. Thank you.
I just want to, you guys have been my comrades. And I didn't know, because I'm not traditionally on the left. Now I've come to the left, and that's where I've gotten support and succor, and you guys have just been great, and I thank you. It's extremely meaningful spiritually.
This is Michael Ratner. When Phil Weiss and I were debating this question of have things changed for the better for the Palestinians, media, etc., one thing Phil mentioned was there hasn't been a ground invasion yet in this particular assault on Gaza. And he thought that was restraint caused by some of the changes in the media and other places. And just as we finished the interview with Phil, I came across this New York Times headline, Gaza invasion is likely, Israeli official says. That's July 16th at 1:30 today. Senior military official said the likelihood of invasion was very high as the Palestinian death roll reached 205, including 4 children killed on the beach. It wasn't just Schopenhauer who was a great German pessimist. I'm a great American pessimist.
We're now joined by Andrew Cotty, a Palestinian human rights activist, to hear his perspective on the situation in the Middle East.
Andrew Cotty, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What, in your opinion, are the Israelis trying to accomplish here? And secondly, what do the Palestinians hope to get through when they get through with this? What do you think is going on there?
Well, I mean, I think that in terms of Israeli goals, I would say that it's evident from Israel's last, I mean, you have the November 2012, and then obviously the infamous Operation Cast Lead of 2008-2009, both led to what I would say is probably a higher level of rocket fire. In fact, I think that the Palestine Center, the Jerusalem Fund Palestine Center, published an infographic sort of showing how the rocket attacks have actually only increased. And I think that that's the product of a more militant and resistant society that understands that Israel will pummel them at will at any time that they feel like it. I don't necessarily know that Israel has any real goals that will benefit Israeli society other than possibly the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza and, you know, forcing them to move out. And even as we know, even that's not necessarily possible. I mean, they're leaving Gazans in pretty deplorable conditions, and obviously they have unilaterally absolved themselves of their legal obligation under international law to the population in Gaza, and have instead declared something that I don't think anyone else recognizes, that Gaza is somehow a hostile territory or an enemy territory.
Let me ask you, Andrew, you said something interesting to me, which is the rocket attacks have increased with each Israeli attack, 2008-9, 2012, and now today when there are, from my gross looking at the papers, a lot more attacks. If that's the case, isn't the Israeli policy counterproductive? Why are they doing it then?
I mean, I think it's counterproductive if your belief is that the goal or the end goal for the Israeli government is peace. So for sure, it is counterproductive to peace. Is that the objective of the Israeli government? I would say that Israeli government policies over the last 67 years have proven themselves to be mostly focused on relieving the state of Israel of the burden of the indigenous Palestinian population, and having them leave by any means necessary. In terms of the rocket fire, I mean, I would say that first, I think just to clarify what we're talking about when we say rocket attacks, the majority of these rocket attacks are pretty small projectiles that, as anyone who's seen them knows, have virtually no chance of actually injuring anyone or causing damage. Now, of course, Hamas has employed some larger rockets more recently. In the past 4 years, we've seen some that can fire through a building, and I know that there have been a number of Israeli casualties, somewhere around 10 over the last decade as a result of these rocket attacks. But by and large, the rocket attacks that Israel references when they're giving these obscene counts of 500 and 600 rocket attacks are typically projectiles that basically have no chance of reaching anything and can barely do anything. I mean, some of them are as small as a Coke can, which is ridiculous. So I would call these rocket attacks, by and large, with the exception of the ones that Hamas has been launching. And as we know, Hamas is not the only group responsible for these attacks. By and large, actually, these attacks are being carried out by other groups round the clock, the ones that Israel is referring to, are usually other groups that have nothing to do with Hamas and that are actually trying to undermine Hamas oftentimes. I would say the rocket attacks are a cry for help from Gaza. In the end, Gazans are isolated. There's a siege and blockade that Israel is carrying out, and I think that Gazans don't want to be subject to it anymore. They want to be able to live like any other population. And by continuing the siege and blockade, Israel's only increasing the pressure and the likelihood of more militant, armed militant action.
Andrew Cotty, you've been a human rights activist on this issue for many years. What can our listeners do to get involved to support the Palestinians?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you know, the American Friends Services Committee published a list of American companies directly involved and complicit in the attacks on Gaza. Now, this is not necessarily something we can all take action on, obviously, because, you know, outside of divestment, we don't all have individual purchasing power to get some of these things, but some of them we can. So those companies include Boeing, Hewlett-Packard, Elbit Systems, which is an Israeli company that has a base here in the U.S. and is also involved in the building of the U.S.-Mexico border wall, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and GE, General Electric. Of course, also Northrop Grumman and the Raytheon company are involved. So I would say for sure Hewlett-Packard is a company that folks have the option of boycotting. And I would say that, as folks know, in 2005, Palestinian civil society called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until it complies with three tenets of international law, those being an end of the occupation, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the right of refugees to return to their homes or to return, period. So other companies I think that folks can boycott, and I would say that boycott is the strongest action we can take in lieu of our government cutting aid to Israel and larger actions like that happening, and our government no longer being part of, UN veto for Israel. Some of the companies that people can boycott are Ahava Cosmetics, which is sold in stores in the U.S., which is a Dead Sea cosmetic. Another one is SodaStream, which is built in Israeli settlements. Folks do not know that the Strauss Group, which owns Sabra Hummus and Max Brenner, is actually a proud supporter of the Israeli army, as declared on their own website. And also Osem, which owns Tribe Hummus, another brand of hummus here in the U.S., is involved in food service contracts with the Israeli army. So those are a few of the businesses. I mentioned Hewlett-Packard. I think that's a start. People can boycott. Also the Sabon Company, by the way, which has stores throughout New York and I think also in Chicago. Those are a few of the Israeli brands that people can boycott. And when I said civil society, Palestinian civil society called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, I'm referring to over 170 organizations on the ground in Palestine and around Palestine. And those include trade unions, healthcare provider associations.
Andrew, if I might, I'd like to ask you a personal question. How did you get involved in this activity in support of the Palestinians?
Well, you know, during the second Intifada, also known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada of 2000, I started to read a bit more and became a little more aware because my mother's family are Palestinian citizens of Israel. And I was very curious about what was going on. To date, I hadn't learned a lot about the issue, and I think part of that is the pressure that Palestinian Americans come under to keep their lips sealed and not to mention the issue for fear of retribution or problems getting jobs and things like that. So I started to learn about the issue around that time. You know, initially I bought into these ideas of, you know, buzzwords like pragmatism and peace in the sense of, you know, the peace process. The issue of, you know, moderation and ideas of, and then eventually I evolved to realizing that most of these things were founded on complete dishonesty and were intended specifically to be employed to work in Israel's favor. And so, you know, a few years down the line, as the Palestinian civil society call came out, I realized I had an obligation to be working for not only my family's but all Palestinians' rights. Yeah, I mean, that's essentially how I got involved. Over time, I think I started to realize more and more of what was going on generally in the U.S., the way that people view the issue, the lack of information, and for sure, I mean, the complicity of our institutions, our media, and others in not delivering the entire truth about what we're fiscally supporting with each of our tax dollars.
Andrew, let me cut you off for a second because I want to close out this segment with you, which was really intriguing, interesting, and important for us. So I really appreciate it. I'd like you to just tell people where they can read some of the material that you've written, as well as what websites they can go to learn what they can do.
Sure. I mean, my name is Andrew Kadi, K-A-D as in dog, I would say that people can just Google my name and find some of the things I've written for Mondo Weiss, Electronic Intifada, The Guardian's Comment is Free, etc. In terms of you know, materials about how to take action, I'm on the steering committee of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, so I encourage people to go to endtheoccupation.org. And also, I have been involved for years with Adala New York, which is at adalahny.org. Those are the two primary places I would direct folks.
Andrew, thank you very much, and hopefully next time we talk to you, they'll at least the Israelis will have ended their continuous bombardment of Gaza and will be a little more advanced on the road toward Palestinian rights.
I hope so as well.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.